Welcome to Nuclear Matters from the Australian National University College of Systems and Society. I'm your host, Liz Williams, a nuclear physicist and nuclear systems discipline lead for the ANU School of Engineering. What do you think about radioactive waste? This is a question that most nuclear professionals will need to consider at some point in their careers. In today's episode, TELUS CEO and Managing Director Nate Smith joins us to talk about what it's like to establish a radioactive waste facility in Australia. We learn about what radioactive waste is, the many industrial processes, including clean energy technologies, that produce it, and some of the ways this waste is managed. Nate also shares insights into consent-based siting, community engagement with traditional owners, and the importance of building trust. Let's listen in. Thank you so much for joining us today on Nuclear Matters. It's really great to have you come and tell us all about what you're doing at TELUS.
Thanks, Liz. Really happy to be here.
You've become an international expert in consent-based siting of radiological facilities. So I'm wondering if you could tell us about consent-based siting. So what is it and how is this approach carried out in practice?
The concept of consent-based siting, which is a mouthful, to me just comes down to the concept of building trust with your stakeholders. And stakeholders, again, is another big word that people use, but it's with your communities and the people that these projects actually impact. Kind of stepping back, you know, my company and my team were actually the very first management team anywhere in the world ever that has launched a geological repository, or essentially a place that can take low-level radioactive waste end-to-end anywhere in the world.
That's huge.
We did everything from the siting to the community engagement, which I'll get to in a moment. That's the consent-based siting, to the approvals, the design, the construction, and now the operation. We did it end-to-end. We did it in less than 10 years, and we did it for an absolute fraction of what it normally takes governments to launch these things. Usually it takes, you know, 30, 40 years, and it costs taxpayers billions. And it's not like we had some magic, but I think the difference really comes down to the consent-based siting. It comes down to building trust, because that's really what delays these projects. Finding a place to put low-level radioactive waste or spent fuel, and those are different, and we'll probably get into that. Finding the time to do that, or it's not about finding technical places or the geology. It's about finding a community that trusts you and is willing to do it. So stepping back, so what typically happens in these facilities, and you're actually seeing defense and the Commonwealth do this once again, is usually governments, they go and they announce that they're going to run a process, and there's a bunch of communities that, you know, are ideal for these, or this is where we're going to put the site. And that's really what happened, like at Kimba, for example, or that's what's happening right now at Garden Island in Perth. The community is told that, you know, government is going to put radioactive waste there, and now let's engage. We sort of had a view at TELUS that that's not the best way to do it. The best way to do it is to go into community. It's to ask questions, to ask what, you know, aspirations are in that community. And then if there's interest, noting always the community has the veto right because it's their land, particularly here in Australia with traditional owners, it's always their land. They always have a veto. And you build up trust. And then only then, if there's real interest in your project, do you move forward.
Yeah.
So what is consent-based siting? Consent-based siting is obtaining consent or obtaining trust from a community to launch. Now, one other thing that I'll say about consent-based siting, because I think that there is a real error in the methodology or the consideration of consent-based siting. And I'll tell you why it doesn't work anywhere else when led by government.
Why?
It's because the question is, Liz, what is consent?
Mm-hmm.
And I tell you, you go ask this to the United States, United Kingdom, our current government, and no one can give you an answer. And the problem is there's always going to be a vocal minority on anything.
Yeah.
Like, do you like light or dark chocolate? There's going to be some crazy people out there that don't even like chocolate, you know?
Yeah.
and I think, and it's the same thing where something emotive such as waste, any type of waste.
Yeah.
And so I think what we had a little bit more liberty to do was to go and say, look, we've consulted. We believe the vast majority of our community understands that wastes exist in this country and there needs to be a safe place, and then we move forward. I think in democracies and governments where there's going to be political outrage if they move forward with 90% consent, which is massive in a democracy, right? There's always going to be a loud minority. And so I think that there's a fundamental error in the government's concept of consent-based siting because nobody defines what consent is up front. And I think it's really hard to do.
Yeah. Do you think the position that TELUS might have been in is a bit different than a government might find itself in as well? I mean, I'm thinking of the fact that governments, like, let's take Australia, for instance, there's already a history there of how nuclear technologies have been used and managed in this country. And government has played a role in that. And I'm wondering if that potentially impacts on the conversation about what trust looks like and what consent looks like and these kinds of conversations, that perhaps you're in a bit of a different position to handle.
Yeah, look, I'm quite empathetic to the challenges government has in doing this, right? Because I think one of the other benefits and the things that, we had a couple ironclad things when we went and did engagement that we believed in. And one of them was our leaders had to do the engagement. And so I think, you know, we might talk a little bit about one of our projects that we got approved with the Titicaca, which is to build a deep geological repository that's actually approved by the local community group to take international low-level radioactive waste and international chemical waste. That's never been done in the world. And I think it's a great example. When we did those engagements, we were able to make decisions immediately face-to-face with our community. And I think that built credibility. You know, it's a real challenge for government that has multi-layers of decision-making, where if you're going out and you're doing engagement and decision-makers in the community tell someone that they're really upset with a certain decision, you know, it's very difficult for government to say, okay, we won't do that. And to pivot because, you know, there may be policy restraints, there may be budgeting restraints. For us, we thought it was really important to be able to acknowledge concerns on the fly, find compromises. And then what does that do? That builds a relationship. It builds trust. So again, I think that's part of what we, none of this is, again, rocket science. It's just about building a relationship with people. And to build a relationship with people, you know, you have to be able to engage face to face. You have to be able to acknowledge their concerns and you have to be able to make compromises. And if those compromises have to wait on a bureaucratic process that it might take months, it's really hard to acknowledge somebody's feelings and to show that you're listening and you're trying to find a path forward.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. I want to explore that procedure that you might have gone through just because I'm curious about the site selection, et cetera, and identifying which communities you were going to start this conversation with. Because for facilities like this, for instance, the geological state of the area that you're looking at, et cetera, there are a lot of considerations that go into deciding whether a site is appropriate or not. How do you go through thinking about that and then deciding how to approach a community that is in an area where a site like this can be placed?
Look, we're really proud, and I think it's one of the key parts of our intellectual property, is when we started this concept, we believed that the experts in the way governments all around the world had done it were wrong. Where they started with geology, et cetera, as opposed to starting with, again, the decision makers and the roadblocks, which are the people. Mm-hmm. So I think we initially started with around 72 different site selection criteria. That's grown far beyond that. But the interesting part about the way we've handled it is we had the typical things that you'd see in the International Atomic Energy Agency or government, where we had geology and geotechnical risks and groundwater and sensitive receptors and, you know, the true science and complexity around the rock formations themselves. Yeah. But we also placed a huge emphasis on criteria around the community, their history. Did they have strong governance principles and decision-making capacities? Were they familiar with waste? Mm-hmm. Were they familiar with low-level radioactive waste, whether they realized it or not? Were there instances of past projects being successful or failing and why? it was a real focus on the community themselves, right? And although we haven't had a perfect record, I think the proof is in the pudding. Whereas most, I think there's only been, you know, the last facility like ours to get approved in a Western democracy for low-level radioactive waste, I think was 2 decades ago.
Right.
And we have had 3 projects approved for low-level radioactive waste here in Australia in the last 10 years. And I think it goes back to, I think, the way that we've gone about site selection. So again, that's our process. And again, we can go into the scientific things that you require. But again, I want to go back to, it's not finding geology or designs that work, because there is a method to safely and permanently isolate both low-level radioactive waste, which TELUS does, and also spent fuel, which we do not do. But the challenge is building trust with communities and finding a place that is willing to host one of these facilities.
Yeah, that makes sense. Maybe this is a good time to talk about Sandy Ridge and the consent-based siting process you went through there. So as I understand it, the facility has the support of the traditional owners who look after that country,
yes,
the Marlinggulli people. I want to focus on the community engagement aspects of this, which you led, correct?
Look, there's been a bunch of people in our on our team, including our founder many years ago, that started the conversations. But but yes, it's been a key part. The relationship is one that I think is really important for the head of the company or the head of the government entity to hold. And so I feel very humbled to I think have a pretty strong working relationship with the Marlinggulli people, and also the Tichikala that we're working with at Chandler.
I'd like to talk to you about that particular project as well, but I thought I'd start with Sandy Ridge,
sure,
since that one is operating, correct?
Yes, correct.
It's already started taking in waste. We've talked a bit about how TELUS approaches these sitings. I was wondering, what was the conversation like that led to the site for Sandy Ridge being identified?
Can I start with one disclaimer that I think is...
Sure.
Actually, 2 disclaimers that I think are really, really, really important.
Sure.
Number one, I want to make sure that people understand there's 2 main buckets of radioactive waste. There is what most people think of radioactive waste, which is spent fuel. So that's the stuff at the end of the AUKUS submarines, or if, frankly, we ever have nuclear reactors in this country, which we already have one, obviously, Lucas Heights and
Sydney. We have one.
That's correct. That's the spent fuel. That's high-level nuclear or radioactive waste. That requires deep geological disposal.
Yeah.
That requires a facility that will be, you know, 400 plus meters under the ground, where you create an underground vault. That is not what TELUS does. What TELUS manages is actually the year-on-year challenge for AUKUS subs starting next year, and also the big challenges that we have in nuclear medicine. Anyone that's had cancer, uranium mining, critical minerals, water filtration, it's a massive issue here in Australia, the low-level radioactive waste. That can be disposed of at Sandy Ridge, the facility we want to talk about, in a near-surface repository. So that's one disclaimer.
Yep.
Apologies. The second disclaimer I want to call out is that at TELUS, we are agnostic on how the green energy transition needs to occur.
Yep.
So agnostic on whether it's solar or wind or batteries or nuclear, right? But the thing that we're adamant on, and I think this is so important, is every one of those technologies creates waste.
Yes.
Solar panels, lead and cadmium in the panels themselves, toxic acids in the polysilicon, you have hazardous oils and PCBs and wind and hydro, and actually some radioactive material as well. And then critical minerals for our Tesla car batteries create hundreds of thousands of tons of low-level radioactive waste. Nuclear is no different in that it creates hazardous waste. It's just actually a much smaller volume, but a higher contaminant.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I think making those 2 points is, number one, we don't do spent fuel, but we do low-level radioactive waste, which is the bigger volume issue. And then the other piece is that I'm not advocating for nuclear energy, but what I am advocating is for the public to understand that there is not an energy source out there that doesn't create hazardous waste. We have Sandy Ridge, which is operational today, that can take them all.
Those are actually 2 very important disclaimers. And maybe it's worth, for the first one with regards to low-level radioactive waste, maybe let's give somebody a picture of what this might be. So for instance, if you're in a hospital and you are having a procedure that might use a radioactive tracer, this could be like the tissue that they use to make, you know, make sure that they're not transferring radioactive material somewhere they don't want it to to be. Like those kinds of materials that are used for cleaning, that are used for control of small amounts of isotopes, et cetera.
Yeah.
Those are the kinds of things that end up in this waste, right?
100%. So this is like when we start community engagement, one of the first things I question when people say, oh, radioactive waste. I mean, the first thing I ask is, have you or anyone you've loved, have they ever had cancer? And if they have, they have benefited, but also produced low-level radioactive waste, because a lot of the cancer treatments and radionuclides that go into type of cancer treatments produces low-level radioactive waste directly from the reactor here in Sydney. But some of the other really big buckets that people don't realize is anyone that drives a Tesla car battery or that has a long-term battery, the critical minerals and rare earths that go into those actually produce very large amounts of low-level radioactive waste that right now a lot of people don't realize is stored kind of all over Australia. You also have things for certain types of, and I mentioned it before, but water filtration. So the desalinization plants create radioactive waste. Even smaller things, although it's quite low levels, and smoke alarms, for example, yeah. There are sources
yep.
there.
Americium.
Nucleonic fuel gauges. And actually one of the real big ones that people don't quite realize is the offshore oil and gas. There's quite a bit of decommissioning happening now where they're pulling up the offshore assets and bringing them onshore for decommissioning. Well, actually, most of those pipes are contaminated with what's called naturally occurring radioactive material, this or NORM scale. Also, uranium mining, which probably isn't as big of a surprise for a lot of people. But I think the concept is there's a lot of this out there. Now, when we talk about the AUKUS subs that are going to, you know, start docking very, very soon, they are going to create, it's actually not the spent fuel or the high-level waste that's an issue. That'll be an issue in about 50 years. The issue year on year for the next 50 years and the real challenge that the international community needs Australia to solve, and foreshadowing, Sandy Ridge can solve it today, is the low-level radioactive waste. So every year, those submarines will create radioactive, low-level radioactive waste. And honestly, to your question about what is it, it's like, it's the same kind of things you'd have, think about in your, you know, if things you'd see in your kitchen. It's yep. like gloves
yep.
and PPE, and they're contaminated with low-level radiactive material. Now, Sandy Ridge, our operational facility, just to give you a bit of a, I guess, concept on volume, you know, the volumes from here year on year from the AUKUS subs are going to be pretty small, you know, way less than a shipping container, right?
Yeah.
We have accepted at Sandy Ridge from private entities more than three times the Commonwealth's entire inventory of low-level radioactive waste in the last 18 months.
Right. Wow.
It kind of shows you, you know, people are so focused on the low-level radioactive waste of the Commonwealth, from AUKUS subs or from the Lucas Heights reactor, but the private industry has massive amounts of this.
Yeah.
It's just, again, it's not necessarily in the public domain or people aren't thinking about it. So low-level radioactive waste is actually, it's quite common. It's in hospital basements, in kind of in most universities. And until TELUS opened up and got our final approval for low-level radioactive waste in February 2023, There was not a solution to dispose of it.
So tell us about this first facility. You know, how was the site identified? Are there some challenges that you faced in the process that you think would be useful for this community to hear about and learn from?
Well, so first off, at its simplest, what is a geological repository? It's an underground vault for hazardous waste. Now, most people probably know like what a landfill looks like. So a landfill is an open cut mine. It's a hole in the ground that has a liner, right? They put like a big, like kind of plastic liner.
Yeah.
Every single liner breaks. They all break. Okay. Some break in 20 years, some break in 50 years, but every single one breaks. And if you think about it, they're all open to the elements. So you got a lot of trash in this kind of like plastic liner. It's filling up with water from the elements, and it creates hazardous leachate and acids because lots of stuff mixing together. One day when those liners break, you end up with groundwater pollution. It's inevitable. That's the way liners work. That's the way landfills work. Okay. What we've built, a geological repository, is completely different. So it's an open cut mine, but there is no liner.
Right.
So instead, the safety case is purely built around the natural barriers in the environment. And you essentially want four main things. Number one, you want a place that's seismically stable.
Mm-hmm.
And we're actually built on the oldest rock formation in the world, the Yilgarn Craton. So again, because you don't want fissures. If you're storing things like arsenic and mercury and low-level radioactive waste, you don't want fissures from earthquakes. Second thing is you want a place that's dry, because you don't want underground aquifers if there is any leakage in the cell. Our site has zero underground aquifers and hasn't had any for almost, so no groundwater that can go anywhere for almost 100 million years.
Yeah.
Not only that, we have about 10 times the evaporation to rain at our site. Third thing you want is a place that's relatively far away from people. You have to go down a 110-kilometer access road to reach our site. It's about 220 kilometers northwest of Kalgoorlie in Western Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last thing you want is a thick bed of either kaolin clay or salt or granite, something that's quite absorbent. So what we have is we have kaolin clay, and it almost acts like kitty litter if there's ever any leakage in the cell.
Mm-hmm.
But what's really amazing about Sandy Ridge, and it's the reason why, you know, people have written all over the world, it's one of the safest places on the planet, is beneath our kaolin clay, we actually have kilometers of impervious granite, which is actually what you used in high-level spent fuel nuclear repositories. It's one of the safest places anywhere. On top of all of that, we actually put in one of our own innovations where we have one of the world's largest air domes covering the entire site. So the entire site is dry or anaerobic, not only when we mine it, but throughout the whole time when we're emplacing waste.
Right.
So you're basically creating an underground vault. So what we do is we go through, we emplace waste in layers almost like a cake, and you compact kaolin clay. And then when you get to about 4 meters below the surface, we put a seal and cap system in, and it's isolated throughout geological time. And what we're able to do is we can take 280,000 tons of essentially any type of waste. So it's not just low-level radioactive material. It's also arsenic, cyanide, PFAS, cross-contaminated soil. So 280,000 tons of just about any type of hazardous waste from anywhere in Australia or its exclusive economic zone. And it's something that Australia needs, because a lot of people don't realize Australia creates more hazardous waste per person than any country in the world. And before we opened up, you know, this stuff was generally sitting near waterways or going into landfill or is being burned. And, you know, people don't like to talk about waste, but it's something that was needed. So your direct question, you said, tell us about the facility, but what are some of the things we learned, particularly from engagement, et cetera? Again, I think, you know, the biggest learning was in the initial engagement. It was, how do you convey something with respect to waste that a lot of people intuitively know exists, but necessarily don't want to talk about it?
Mm-hmm.
Everybody talks about, you know, we want to have lights on, but we don't necessarily want, and you always hear in our backyard, you want cancer treatment, but you don't want to deal with the waste, right?
Correct.
So it was trying to explain that there is a safe place to manage it, and really going through the process about listening, not talking to people, not talking down to people, but saying, okay, explain to us why you're concerned, and then walking through and trying to find not simple, but plain language ways to explain why those concerns weren't an issue.
Yeah.
And I think a great example of this, and again, one of the things we learned, is that I actually think that technical people, so PhDs and nuclear scientists, although they know the most, they're probably the worst people to do community engagement. And I think the reason why, and I'm not technical, I think the reason why is because if you talk in really complicated language, you know, you have to be able to explain this to just about anyone. And that has nothing to do with education levels, right?
Yeah.
It just has to do with being able to convey it in a way that people can understand. And I think a lot of times you'll find, and you see this all over the world, and we've done tons of case studies and research on engagement, right? A lot of times if you have an expert, they'll talk down to people. They'll say, well, I'm an expert, so, you know, I got a PhD. You know, you don't know what you're talking about. Well, it doesn't really matter if people don't know what they're talking about, because it's their feelings. And if somebody is concerned, well, their feelings are valid. So I think in some ways that was one of our big learnings, is plain language, but also engage with people who know what they're talking about, but don't get into the stage that, hey, we know best because we're the experts.
Just out of curiosity, did you see differences in values or differences in even perceptions of time scales playing a role in these kinds of conversations? And if so, how did you deal with those?
And again, I think it's meeting people on their own ground, simplistically. Maybe a good story, when we were doing the engagement with the Tichakala Native Title community at our Chandler project, which is south of Alice Springs in the Northern Territory, we initially had designed our facility, and it was really for cost reasons, because that facility, by the way, it's a deep geological repository. Mm-hmm. It's about 850 meters below the ground and one of the world's largest salt formations. It's like an underground salt formation that's the size of a small city. It's pretty phenomenal. One of the big questions, though, is we initially were going to start to tunnel downwards going through these hills, because that saves quite a bit of money.
But
look, we weren't able to understand or be told, because of, you said, different value sets or perspectives, why those hills were important, but it became quite clear that they were. And I assume it was something of religious significance, right? And basically there was something really emotional about those hills, but we couldn't be told directly, right? And eventually we just said, look, are those hills important? Simply, they were. And so we said, well, we'll move the project. And it was just like silence, right? We'll just move the project. It's going to cost us a lot more money, but remember, it's on their land. We want them to be proud and happy and not have lasting scars about a project that will be there for 100 years. So we just moved the project. But I think it was interesting because from a time scale or perspective, from a Western religion and a different view, to me, I wouldn't have necessarily have seen that. But for their value set, there was obviously something that was really important. And I think acknowledging that was crucial.
Yeah. Well, I think also it sounds like you took their concerns at face value. You didn't try and challenge the concerns. The site with the Tichakala people, as I understand it, that almost didn't get approved. Is that right? Were the hills part of that, or was the conversation broader than that?
That was, I think, a misstep by TELUS initially. And I think it's, we took a lot of learnings from that. So when TELUS was actually first established, this was before me. So Sandy Ridge is our operational facility, right? Chandler is not yet operational, but the vision of TELUS started with Chandler. But the focus when former TELUS management went to engage with the Tichakala Native Title community and with the Northern Territory was that would be a salt mine, because, by the way, we will be mining almost 800,000 tons of rock salt, which will be exported to Asia.
Okay.
The focus was on salt and not on waste. But I think, you know, when we made a decision, because that was a much bigger project, to halt that and focus on Sandy Ridge. Mm-hmm. And when we came back and looked at, did we restart engagement in Chandler? So we paused around 2018 and we started to re-engage in 2021, 22. There was a question about, well, what went wrong in those previous engagements? And I think it went back to like core values, trust, right? Like the core purpose of this, it wasn't wrong to say it was a salt mine, but the core purpose of it was to be a waste repository.
Yeah.
And that's okay, right? So what we did is when we went back and engaged, we said a couple things. Number one, we said, hey, just to start, to be clear, this is your land. So you got a full veto. If you don't want the project, we're going to move away, right? But if you do want the project, under what circumstances would it be something you'd be proud of? And just to be clear, this will be a waste repository. We think it's needed for all the reasons we kind of talked about earlier in the past. And actually, why Chandler is needed is a much larger conversation. But that's what happened. And then, you know, there was trust building. It took a few years, took a lot of engagement, and really, really proud of the fact that, you know, we're hopefully going to launch that project. It'll create 100 years of jobs. It'll totally transform that very remote community. And, you know, our hope is to do it in a real partnership model. Really, really excited about it.
Why the Chandler site you mentioned that was special?
So Sandy Ridge, our operational facility in Western Australia, is focused on, it only takes Australian domestic waste. That is, we said, is a near surface geological repository. So remember, kind of an open cut mine. That is much cheaper to build. Even if you're not technical, you can understand it would be much cheaper to build than digging down, you know, 400 to 800 meters into the earth.
Yeah.
So Chandler was a much, much bigger project. Chandler, again, is talking about, you know, digging annually 800,000 tons of rock salt, shipping it from one of the most remote areas in the world, in the dead center of Australia, and then emplacing waste. Sandy Ridge is large enough to take all of the waste, all of the low-level radioactive waste and chemical waste in Australia. It can manage it by itself, but it's about one-tenth mm-hmm. of the cost.
Yeah.
So one of the big things was going into the Titch Collins saying, look, if you want this, if it's going to cost 10 times what Sandy Ridge did, I mean, it's basic economics. You have to find another market. So the market was international waste. Okay. Now, one of the first things that we talked about, and this actually wasn't from the Tichikala Native Title community, it was actually more from their lawyers and some politicians, was the question about, well, you know, it's international, or are you dumping it on, you know, someone's, you know, local community? But I thought one of the really interesting things that as we did that engagement, you know, one of the first things that, you know, came across was Tichikala kind of see themselves, they see themselves as their own nation. So to them, international waste could be coming from Sydney as much as coming from Singapore. So look, the point is why do we need Chandler? The reason is because this will not be China's dumping ground. That's not what this is about, right? This is about, there's all this hope to move towards a green economy from our strategic partners throughout the Pacific, New Zealand, Singapore, Japan, Indonesia, Papua New Guinea. But guess what? Those places, remember, what did I say you need for a geological repository? Seismically stable and dry. None of those places have anywhere to put this waste. None of them. And what we have is here we are exporting a lot of the mining materials that create these wastes in these countries. I think that in the Tichikala Native Title community, as we talked about this, they're really proud of the fact that we can actually play a part in cleaning them up. It'll be going to one of the safest places on the planet when we build it, but it'll actually be able to enable these green economies. Kind of stepping back, one great example, right? There's a lot of discussion in the news about a year ago on nickel. So in Australia, the nickel industry, it's quite waste intensive. Sandy Ridge helps with that. But there was a large discussion about, well, Indonesia is creating lots of dirty nickel, right? Because they're dumping a lot of their tailings. But guess what? Where are they supposed to put it? It's in an island nation where they're trying to drive economic value. The only way you can have green nickel is if there's a place to put hazardous waste. There's nowhere to put it. What Chandler will enable is for these different places to actually clean up. And I think that's what's so hard to convey a lot. But when we actually get to sit down with green groups or sit down with communities, is say, hey, you want the jobs, you want power, yet at this, you want cancer research, but at the same time, there has to be a place to put it. Well, I think that that's what's really unique, is what Chandler is going to do is it's going to help our strategic partners move into a greener economy, which is going to make a greener Asia Pacific and world, which will benefit Australia. But it also create 100 years of jobs, be a multi-billion dollar project in the Northern Territory that'll create jobs not only in Darwin, where we're importing waste and exporting salt, but also at the different rail lines and also in the Tichikala community. It'll revitalize Alice Springs. And honestly, we'll have some of the highest levels of indigenous employment anywhere in the world. And look, really excited. And I honestly feel, I think the challenge we feel at TELUS there is this real weight of responsibility to deliver that project, because it's something that nobody's ever done before. And I think the first thing when people hear international waste, they freak out and they're like, this is bad. But you know, my request to anybody listening that get their hackles up is look into why we're doing it and talk to our real community. I think it'll be a real game changer if we can get it up and running.
Yeah. I think part of what you've just said kind of highlights the challenge that comes from not being accustomed to thinking about the full life cycle of many of these technologies that we are using every day. Starting from where materials are mined, all of the materials that are mined, all the way to the end state of whatever it is that we are, whatever technology we're talking about, there is a point at which it's finished and we're done using it and we need to deal with that from a waste perspective. So there's that whole life cycle, and it's often I mean, in nuclear, to some extent, we have to think across that whole life cycle simply because of the...
But no one else does, Liz. So I'll tell you what, correct. I'll tell you what, a great example is when you go to the AFR Sustainability Summit every year for 3 days, and when people talk about ESG and sustainability, all anyone ever talks about is carbon, which, by the way, is really important. I'm not a climate change denier. I believe in it. However, you know, the fact of the matter is that the impacts of climate change, although they're coming, you know what the near-term impact on our environment right now? It's the PFAS that's in breast milk and in every human's body. It's the mercury that's already poisoning our fisheries. Yeah. It's the waste that right now is sitting on sites all over Australia with no place to go, poisoning groundwater and crops. But no one talks about that end-to-end piece when they're talking about ESG and sustainability. And I think you are right, bringing it back to the nuclear conversation, is that yes, nuclear is unique. And that's why I go back to saying agnostic on nuclear energy, but every type of power generation creates waste. Nuclear is just one of the only ones that is actually required to find a place to put it. But look at most of these mines, right? Or look at most of these power generation sites. Go to any coal-fired power station. What about those, you know, football fields of ash dams that, by the way, do have naturally occurring radioactive material? Where is that going? There was no plan up front, right? And actually, the size is way bigger and it's near water, etc. So look, I am not throwing stones at any of these. I like being able to heat my home and have hot water, etc.
Yeah.
But I think you're exactly right. And my hope is that sustainability and conversations of ESG, they grow to the point where they're discussed end to end, which has to include the waste. And I think a lot of times because it's gross, it's waste, nobody wants to talk about it. But that's actually what's harming the environment right now, whether people like it or not.
Yeah, no, dealing with waste is crucially important and has long-term consequences if it's not done well, and we're already seeing that. I am also agnostic from an energy perspective. My hope is that we start to do that end-to-end comparison across a number of different technologies and making contextually appropriate choices with regards to how we continue to heat our homes and so on. The thing I would like to ask you, this aligns with the reflective practice, which is something that we have to build into our engineering programs, for instance. Looking back at the projects that we've done or the work that we've done and thinking about, well, what can we learn from that? How can we improve these, you know, our practices in the future? What are some of the lessons that we can learn for the next time that we are, for instance, standing up a facility like Sandy Ridge or the one that you've got approved in Chandler? Like, what are some of those pieces that we can sort of share with the listeners here that they might be able to think about in their own practice?
Yeah, I think one of the reflective practices, and this is one that we saw both in Australia, but also all over the world, and I think it's something that we implemented. The World Bank has reached out to us about it, actually, and we're really proud of it, is I think there has to be money and a scheme or system to guarantee that cleanup happens and that taxpayers aren't left holding the bag. So almost every energy project out there today in Australia, almost every mine, what do you think what happens when the mine or whatever closes and there's all the waste? What do they say?
We're going to do the minimum job required by law to clean it up.
I mean, a lot of my clients, I think, want to do the right thing. I really do believe that. But I think what they say is, we don't have the money. We don't have the money, right? Because usually what happens is the cleanup is an unfunded liability on a balance sheet. Okay. What we wanted to do is when we launched our facility, especially because it was the first of its kind, we wanted to guarantee that there was no way the liability could ever come back to taxpayers, our community, or our clients. So what we did is we created this financial assurance structure. So think about a trust or like a bank account that we can't touch. It's the sole owner of the trust is the WA government. It grows throughout time like a superannuation fund, and there's a manager of it. It's audited every few years to make sure there's enough money. And behind it was really detailed modeling and scenario analysis of every bad thing that could happen at our site. So it was so extensive that we modeled crashing a 747 into an open pit of low-level radioactive waste. And basically the concept is that trust had to have enough money that if we ever fall over or when we close, it will enable the WA government to step in, take ownership of the site, and monitor the site for 100 years post-closure. That 100-year post-closure is called the institutional control period, which is really driven by the decay of the radioactive waste that we take, just to be clear. But that essentially enables our facilities backstopped by the WA government. We've cash funded all of our closure. And I think that's something that I'd love to see not only in, you know, nuclear, but frankly, and nuclear actually does do that across the world. It does. It's one of the only industries that does. What I'd love to see that is more in other types of energy generation or mining. A great example, and by the way, love solar, not throwing stones at it, but I think most solar, right, you go out there and you create these and, you know, no matter what anybody says, only like 10% of the panels are actually recycled. And there's no scheme right now for all these massive amounts of panels. Like, where are they going to go? Right now, they're going into landfill. And by the way, they have lead and cadmium, which is extremely hazardous. And I think, again, that's one of the learnings that I'd like to see in all new projects, is kind of taking the lead on what Little Tellus did, which is making sure that you've cash backed your closure, because that's the right thing to do from a sustainability perspective.
That's a really interesting model for actually approaching that like long-term view of how to responsibly set something up. You've worked in a number of different industries and previously in the US, and you have a law background. I'm wondering how you came to join Tellus and do the work that you're doing.
I've been really lucky. My wife and I grew up in the States. When I graduated, I was a strategy consultant for a while, and then I went to law school, which is a postgraduate endeavor in the United States. You can't study it undergrad. And after that, I spent, you know, kind of a decade practicing all over the world. You know, I worked in Italy and London and the United States. And I was really lucky when we had our second daughter to practice here in Australia for a little while. And I realized what I think most of your listeners understand, that this is the greatest country in the world. And but I made a massive mistake and I left and I went into business at UPS, the shipping and logistics company. It's a values-based company, really enjoyed working there. And what's neat is because of the growth of e-commerce, you know, they were trying to have a footprint in every country in the world. So I did deals, you know, 72 different countries. It was awesome. But to be frank, my wife and I, we now have four little kids. We really believed that this is the greatest country in the world to raise children. And it was a place we wanted to move to. Mm-hmm. I'm getting my citizenship. I'm never leaving. So as part of that, we started to look, well, how do we come back? And I had heard about the Sandy Ridge project a long time ago, but it was floundering a bit. They didn't have their approvals. So I actually used to advise the old CFO at Tellus when I was a lawyer here in Australia, and he was at Atlas Iron. Mm-hmm. And he gave me a real opportunity where him and the founder said that they'd sponsor me to come out here. I'd help them get their approvals. And to be frank, I thought that then I'd go out and set up another business. But the founder had some family issues and had to step away. And when he did, and we didn't yet have the approvals done, I was lucky enough to get the CEO gig. And then that's sort of what's happened afterwards. But the way that I described it when talking to the board is, you know, I came from a logistics business that did above ground warehousing. And really what Sandy Ridge and these geological repositories are, they're logistics businesses, right? You got to move stuff and it's an underground permanent warehouse. It's an underground vault. That's what it is.
Yeah. Well, I would imagine that would be a useful background if you're trying to think about, you know, transporting low-level radio.
You have to be able to do
across.
It safe.
Well, you have to do it safe, but you also, I mean, I'm just thinking about state boundaries in Australia, even transporting across those. I mean, there's some interesting legislation that relates to that, yes?
There is, but you know, I think what's really important to note to anybody that's concerned that it can't be done, we have moved low-level radioactive waste from every state and territory in Australia, every mainland state and territory in Australia. So it can be done, and it's being done safely today.
How much has Sandy Ridge taken in thus far?
We've taken somewhere around 150,000 tons since fully opening up 2 years ago, and somewhere around 10,000 tons of low-level radioactive waste. Okay.
And what's the largest volume of material that you have in the facility? Do you know?
I mean, one of the biggest ones, to be honest, is cross-contaminated soils. So a lot of people talk about PFAS. Mm-hmm. So we've taken quite a bit of cross-contaminated soils with PFAS. That's a really large amount. But we've also taken the other probably largest one is, we'll just call it tailings and byproducts from critical minerals.
Yeah.
So I think this is really interesting. Critical minerals is a crucial part of our transition to the green economy, but they actually produce more waste than anybody right now. Look, we're really proud to enable that. The other one that's really ramping up is the new energy from waste plants. Waste to energy plants in Western Australia. they create a byproduct that's hazardous that we take as well. And so those are probably the large ones. The ones that I think the real focus for us though always is we built this facility to solve Australia's issues with low-level radioactive waste. That's why we built it. We built it to, take all of the low-level radioactive waste that's sitting in warehouses in Sydney near Anzio, to take the stuff from hospital basements, to help with AUKUS. And so my real hope is after this election, we'll have a chance to engage with government and actually be able to solve that.
Okay. Excellent. Well, this episode will air after the election, so I suppose we'll find out what happens. We might follow up with you and find out what's going on.
I have one other project mm-hmm. that might be interesting. I mentioned that we have three projects that deal with radioactive waste. Yeah. There's Chandler and Sandy Ridge we've talked about. Mm-hmm. There's one other one that is a world's first as well. Pretty excited about it. So to deal with spent fuel or high-level radioactive waste,
There's
really only two ways to do it permanently. One is theoretical and one is in practice, okay? The one that we talked about in practice is deep geological disposal. That's where you create a large underground geological repository, usually in hard rock or salt, and you do that somewhere remote. It's kind of like Chandler, only it's specifically designed for high-level waste.
Yeah. Okay?
That's being done in Finland, for example. Theoretically, though, for countries that have smaller volumes of spent fuel, think most countries in the world, most of the European countries, Australia, spending tens of billions of dollars on a deep geological repository doesn't make a lot of sense. So there's been a concept about what if they did something called borehole disposal?
Oh, yeah.
Borehole is think about creating a much smaller hole, like if you're digging an oil well, going like 4 to 5 kilometers down into deep hard rock, and instead placing canisters, small canisters of fuel there. And the unique part about deep borehole disposal, and this was really, the concept is really pushed by our own CSIRO here in Australia mm-hmm. and taken up internationally. The concept is, well, you could do that at the site of a reactor.
Yeah.
So you could actually dispose on site. It'd be amazing, right? The challenge has been, though, is that nowhere in the world have we been able to get social license and community approval to do a demonstration project. Because you actually have to dig the hole, you have to put benign canisters, so no waste, put down there, make sure it works. Got to make sure it works.
Yeah.
I heard somebody at the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna talking about this, and I just called them up and I said, well, we'll do it. And everybody laughed. They said, no way. We've been trying for 30 years. But I tell you, we've got great regulators and community, and there hasn't been much written, even though we're really proud of it. Mm. We got full approval. We go do it tomorrow. Full approval to dig up to 8 demonstration boreholes.
Wow.
At Sandy Ridge. So I think initially CSIRO, and there's been a bit of change in policy. I think the Australian Radioactive Waste Agency was set up, and I think they're still evaluating different methods that the Commonwealth wants to approach. Mm-hmm. That's out there as well. And, we got invited kind of all over the world to talk about this.
Yeah.
But that to us is something, again, that's not, Sandy Ridge will not be digging boreholes to put high-level waste. It'll be there to prove out a technology that would benefit the rest of the world.
Yeah.
We're also not looking to take intellectual property. That for us is just trying to enable a technology. So, if any interested scientists anywhere are listening, give me a call.
Yeah, yeah. There's a paper out there that I think you are on, and also Tim Senden over in the Research School of Physics is on this particular concept. I can probably share the link to that paper in the show notes.
ANU actually was a key part of helping do some of the design, and we had talked about partnering with ANU when we do our first demonstration project. You guys have some technology that I think would really help if it ever moves along.
Yeah, awesome.
But that would have to be, but that really would have to be funded by government.
Yeah. Well, it's always the way, right? We have to find funding to do these cool stuff. So, but yeah, I can share a link to that paper in our show notes so that people who might be interested in this from a research perspective can have a look and
that'd be excellent.
Get in touch.
And I will say, because I would imagine academics are some of your podcast listeners, we have labs and on-site facilities to basically run lots of trials and research projects. And that's one of the things that we're, Sandy Ridge, our vision, and we have an innovation arm called Sandy Ridge Labs, where we've actually found quite a few circular economy technologies. if you have a paper or an interesting project, you know, we have all these hazardous wastes in one place dealing with it safely. We have labs. We'd love to enable different research projects and for really to be a home of innovation here in Australia. So I'm really keen to promote that.
That sounds amazing. Thank you so much, Nate. This has been an incredible episode. I've learned so much and I look forward to sharing this with our listeners. Nuclear Matters is a production of the Australian National University College of Systems and Society. We acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which this podcast is being recorded on or listened to, and pay our respects to their elders and all First Nations people. If you liked what you heard today, please share this episode with friends, family, and colleagues. If you want to send us some feedback on an episode, please email us at nuclearmatterspodcast@anu.edu.au. Keep in mind that this podcast is intended for information and education only. The views and opinions expressed in each episode are those of the individual speakers and do not represent the official policy or position of the Australian National University College of Systems and Society or the university as a whole.